Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You've probably forgotten a lot of things about being a kid. Maybe the names of some of your classmates or the details of a vacation you took before a certain age. But if you were targeted by a bully, if you went to school every day dreading, taunting, intimidation, or physical abuse by a peer, afraid to even spot your tormentor across the playground or in the hallway, that kind of thing most victims never forget. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. So in what ways is bullying bad for victims, and how long do those effects last? And if we all start life fairly powerless, what builds a bully in the first place? Nadine Connell believes these are important questions to investigate, and she's discovered some surprising answers. She is assistant professor of criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas and co-author of two recent studies about the causes of bullying and the effects of victimization. She joins us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Nadine, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I want to start with what should be a simple question. What counts as bullying?
I wish that was a simple question. One of the things that we really try to do when we talk about bullying is talk about the power differential that exists for students in these situations. So we're talking about repeated instances of behavior that's really meant to be hurtful on purpose for a child that's going to have a real negative effect on their day. So it's going to be in such a way that they don't get to be as safe in school, or they aren't able to have as many friends to play with, or they're very isolated. So we're really talking about repeated behavior with a goal to hurt another student.
Is bullying a behavior, or is it a character description?
That's a great question. And we have to define it as a behavior when we're trying to measure and understand it, because we don't always know why students are acting like bullies. And there are a lot of different explanations for that based on a variety of research that's coming to the forefront. And so it's unfair to say that a child who behaves in this way is always going to behave in this way. And that's the other reason we think of it as a behavior, is because it can be changed.
One of the things you discovered was that people who bully other people in adolescence are more likely to be engaged in criminal behavior as adults. First of all, does that mean that there's something different about childhood bullying and bullying that continues or begins in like the teenage years?
I think there's a couple of different ways that we have to look at that. Yes, some research that I did with some colleagues, including those at the University of Texas at Dallas, but also at the University of Cambridge, examined bullying behavior at 14 and how that predicted later outcomes in criminal behavior. And it was really astonishing how well just saying at 14, yes, I bullied, was able to predict really not only long-term, but serious criminal behavior in later adulthood. And so we think of 14 as just a regular teenage year. It's not necessarily young childhood, still sort of that adolescent, early adulthood time, but that persistence suggests that there is a potential for antisocial behavior to really have a cumulative long-term effect. And so, again, don't want to say that kids who bully at 14 can't change, because we know they can, but it's one of the reasons we want to take it so seriously, is because it can have this cumulative long-term effect that we worry about for society.
What does the bully get from bullying?
Bullies seem to get a few different things from bullying. Obviously, there's a power that comes from that, is that you have control over a situation. And for some students, we know that they're coming from very powerless places in their own life, especially in their home life. And we do know that there seems to be some relationship there. So they're getting it with their peers and they're getting attention. And some of that behavior can actually increase their popularity, which is a reinforcement that we'd like to change, but increases the behavior as well.
So are they popular because other kids think it's cool that they're bullying, or are they popular because nobody wants to cross them and be the next target?
You know, it's probably a little bit of both. And that's one of the reasons when we talk about preventing bullying, we talk about promoting tolerance and promoting good behavior as being the kind of behavior you want your popular kids to be undergoing and showing for everyone else.
Is it pretty characteristic, Nadine, of bullies to know that they bully? You say that you asked people and they said at 14, yes, I bullied. This is not something that like later on they don't even realize they did?
I've met a lot of adults who probably later on don't realize that they were bullies, but in fact were. So I think it matters if we ask them the kinds of behaviors that they're doing. So students will often admit the behavior, but don't always call it bullying. So that is something that we're working on trying to better understand, is what do victims consider bullying, but also what do perpetrators consider bullying? Because sometimes kids, oh, I was just having fun, I was just kidding, and they don't recognize the behavior for as hurtful as it really is.
And you can certainly imagine, you know, the milder forms of this. Somebody, you know, was kind of thoughtlessly cruel or unkind to someone else. The victim is going to remember that and really internalize it in a way that the perpetrator might just not even really have noticed.
No, that's very true. And that's one of the reasons when we're talking about bullying, we really stress repeated instances, because if it's a one-time thing, it can absolutely affect a person, but it's a different kind of effect. And when we work with victims, we also want to work on things like resilient skills, because we're all going to have somebody say something thoughtless to us in the course of our lives, and we need to be able to respond to that in a way that doesn't negatively affect us. And so we want to help victims to also be able to recognize the difference between somebody who's targeting them, which is something that has to be dealt with immediately, and somebody who's just being mean. And adolescence is a time of development, so we do expect that there's going to be some kids being mean to each other, and we deal with that a little differently.
Is there a difference between bullying or someone who's called a bully who is just aggressive to everyone as opposed to someone who chooses specific targets?
That's something we're still trying to better understand. It is easier to determine a student who's just being aggressive to everybody, because teachers and adults are probably more likely to notice that than somebody who is targeting one individual specifically. Because if they're targeting, they're probably being a little smarter about it, and they're making sure that there are no teachers and adults around. That said, based on what we know about aggressive behavior, we can definitely surmise that there are probably differences between those two types of children, and they would need different kinds of interventions.
You mentioned earlier that some bullies seem to be trying to compensate for a feeling of powerlessness that may exist at home or elsewhere. Talk about the risk factors. Some of them are surprising to me, that are associated with higher levels of bullying behavior.
We were surprised as well at some of these risk factors. When we looked at trying to predict later bullying behavior, what we saw is that a lot that was happening in family and schools seemed to make an impact. So we're talking about things like poor grades. We're talking about low popularity. But we're also talking about things like the birth of a sibling, which in an academic paper for us is really indicative of disruption in the family. And if that disruption is not addressed, it can have these consequences that we don't expect. So this is not us saying only have one child. I want to be really clear about this. But this is about recognizing that things that happen in the family will affect children differently. And so we just need to keep our eye out when change happens to make sure that we're helping children address that change in positive ways.
Having, I guess, a chronically ill sibling is a factor as well.
When we really sat back and thought about what it meant to have a chronically ill sibling, that started to make sense to us, because I imagine if a family is dealing with a very serious illness of one child, the other child may not feel like they have as much attention, or they may feel that they have to be on their best behavior at home because they don't want to stress out mom and dad in a situation that's already very difficult for everybody. So now they're acting out in other ways for attention. And when we stop and think about it that way, that makes a little bit more sense. So it tells us that we need things like respite programs or more attention paid from a caregiver perspective to the other children in a family, as well as any chronically ill children that are part of the family.
What wasn't on the list of risk factors, at least in your study, were things that I would think would instantly be associated with this: divorce, the death of a parent, poverty is not on the list.
So one of the things that I want to point out about the studies that you're referring to is that this cohort of individuals was 5 years old in 1977. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fair to say that we didn't have enough information to really answer that. As we're talking about a group of kids who did not experience divorce at high rates because it was not as socially acceptable during the time that they were growing up. And so one of the things we would very much like to do is to replicate this in a more current study. And that's just unfortunately a data limitation in getting access and information. But I completely agree with you and think that we would see some changes over time as divorce just becomes common enough that we can account for it in our models.
So tell us about the group that you did study in this cohort and why that group of individuals.
Well, they were available.
Number one.
You know, one of the things about this type of research is it requires a long-term approach. So longitudinal research, we need 15, 20, 25 years of data. And in fact, one of the other studies that we alluded to in England has followed up their individuals up until their 50s and 60s. And so what's great is that this gives us a life course perspective, and it allows us to trace development. But the downside of that is we are looking at individuals who are in their 30s now, and obviously what it means to be a teenager and what it means to be bullied has really changed in the last 30 years. So this particular sample comes out of a northeastern city, primarily white middle class, although we do have both boys and girls, which is different than a lot of other longitudinal studies in criminology. So we were grateful for that. But it's a blue collar area, but a blue collar area that's probably closer to upper middle class. So we are talking about findings to a very specific group and a very specific point in time. It gives us some hints as to what to do going forward, but certainly doesn't answer all the questions that we want to ask.
What is the difference between bullying and other kinds of bad behavior among kids? Because there are people who are concerned that the term is thrown around too loosely today and that we may be labeling kids bullies who just had a bad day.
You know, I think I'm really glad you asked that because I share that concern that we're using the term bully everywhere. It's in the paper. It's all around us. But I think one of the things that we have to remember to separate it out is, first of all, that repeatedness. It's a repeated target. So if your child is getting feedback from the same person every time they go out to recess, then that's something you want to worry about. Where if it's Johnny didn't want to sit with me at lunch today, that's probably because Johnny had a bad day and that's not a big deal. Developmentally, children and adolescents are going to be figuring out their friendship groups and they're going to be figuring out how to behave, and we have to give them room to do that. So what we really look for, again, is that repeated target behavior that is purposely hurtful. And I think that we have to remember that it's okay to not want to play with somebody at recess. As adults, we don't have to sit with anybody at the lunch table that we don't want to. And so we want to give students the freedom to have that same autonomy without calling them a bully, as long as we're teaching them how to do that respectfully. And that's, I think, the big difference is, can you respectfully say to somebody, I don't want to play with you right now? Or are you saying to somebody, I don't like you and you're a bad person, and you're doing that over and over again? Then we're bullying.
We're speaking this hour with Nadine Connell. She is assistant professor of criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about what turns kids into bullies and what happens to bullies and their victims in the long term. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Nadine Connell, Assistant Professor of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about what happens to victims of bullies in the long term and what turns kids into bullies in the first place. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. What does bullying behavior indicate about the normal development of empathy?
Well, I think one of the things that bullying behavior we have to remember is part of normal development, but it's when a student is or a young person is unable to recognize the harm that they've caused to somebody else that we have to worry about their understanding of empathy. Whereas many students are going to say things that are unkind and unfair to another person. And when it's brought to their attention, they're going to feel bad about it. They're going to apologize and they're not going to repeat it. And so it's when somebody is not able to do that, that we want to take a step back and see what else is going on and see if we can't increase tolerance and increase empathy.
How often is it apparent to adults who are paying attention that a child is a bully, and how often is that child able to conceal the behavior from authority?
Based on the children that I talk to, I would say they're able to conceal pretty well. And even when adults are paying attention, we may not always know the right things to look for. Kids are really great at separating out their own burgeoning identities from the identities that adults want them to be and how they want them to behave. And if you think back to your own childhood, you did not tell your parents everything that you did on purpose because you wanted to create that autonomy from them. And I think that even when we talk to teachers who think they know who the bullies are, they're often surprised at some of the behavior that's happening. And that happens for a lot of reasons, including just the size of classes and the size of schools. But students are a lot more crafty than we give them credit for when they are purposely trying to be bullies or when they are not following the rules as they know them to be.
How often does it happen the way it happens in the movies where there's like the lead bully who's really the mean one and then a group of hangers-on and then some victim?
That's a really good question. And I think the answer to that is it probably happens like that more often than we would like to believe, but not as often as the movies make it portray it out to be. Oftentimes, we see students want acceptance from their peers, and jumping on to somebody else's bullying behavior can be a way to gain acceptance from your peers. You're getting a laugh from the cool kids, or somebody's paying attention to you. And so in environments where that type of behavior is reinforced, we're going to see more kids sort of jumping in on that. But we also see a lot of bullying that happens in isolation. So even bullies who are in isolation. And a lot of times the bullies are not liked by their peers because they're not nice and because they're mean. And so it depends on what kind of bullying we're talking about. When we talk about relational bullying or cyberbullying, there tends to be a lot more jumping on the boat. Whereas if we're talking about physical bullying or beating somebody up, that tends to be more one or two isolated individuals. And other students recognize that, I think, more readily as bad behavior. And so they don't get as involved.
How different are bullying behaviors perpetrated by girls and boys?
Very different. We know that girls are much more likely to be involved in emotional and relational bullying, spreading rumors. I want to point out, though, that boys still do this behavior. So they do it more than we think they do, just not as much as girls do. The cyberbullying seems to depend on actually what kind of cyberbullying we're talking about. Usually we lump it all together. But if you start thinking about things like using different apps. So Instagram is a very popular app for young girls. And so we see bullying on that by girls. But if you talk about video games and talking to each other via video games, you see that to be more likely to be a boy behavior. So the specifics really matter. Boys are more likely to, like I said, to be physical with one another. But girls do, the mean girl stereotype does have some root in reality, unfortunately.
How do you sort of ascertain with kids that they are definitively being cyberbullied? For example, I have teenagers and my son has an Instagram account, and his guy friends, they kind of just trash talk each other whenever they put a picture. And he's assured me, and I'm pretty confident that he's telling me the truth, that that's not bullying, that they just, that's how they relate to one another. But if I didn't know him, I would think this poor child is being just destroyed by this.
No. Actually, I think that's a great example because boys and girls use language differently towards one another. And the trash talking that we hear boys are in sports that doesn't raise any eyebrows for boys, for an outside observer, feels really aggressive and negative. And so we do it in a couple of different ways. One of the things that we can do in studies is we define what bullying means explicitly. So we talk about that repeated part of it. We talk about purposely trying to make be hurtful to somebody. But then we also ask students, you know, not only did these things happen to you or did you do these things, but did you feel that you were being bullied? Because there are some kids that have a lot of resilience, and those are the students we want to understand more about so that we can pass those skills on to others, because we do know that, unfortunately, we're all going to face bad things in life. So having that resilience is just going to help us down the line. But we do ask the students, do you feel like you were bullied in this instance? Because we recognize that sometimes it's just friends being silly, which to them, to adults, it looks a bit more nefarious than it really is.
So Nadine, you wanted to know if the victims of prolonged bullying have a particular risk for substance use and substance abuse. What you found was both maybe optimistic and also a little bit depressing. Tell us your conclusion.
Yeah, so one of the things that we were really interested in is the long-term effects of being a victim, because there's a lot of research that tells us that these are very serious consequences. And up until we look at things like suicide in adolescence and high school, so really things that we're very concerned about. And so we wanted to know, were there other types of risk factors associated with being a victim? And we're very interested in substance use and substance abuse because, first of all, it's a problem with teenagers, is we do worry about teenagers using drugs, and we want to understand why. And we know a lot of teenage substance use can also be related to self-medication or trying to really disappear and retreat from problems. And so that, to us, said, well, bullying victimization could be one of those things you're trying to retreat from. And our findings were not what we expected, but that's why we do research. And so we found that for most kids, being bullied early in school years, and so we're talking elementary school here, was not predictive of a substance use behavior. The exception was for those who were in the highest risk factor for being bullied. So a lot of bullying and a lot of serious bullying did increase some smoking and some marijuana use. And so it wasn't all of the drugs, but again, this is a sample that probably had a lower drug use or availability of different kinds of drugs than we would see available today, for instance. So we do want to be cautious about that. But on the one hand, it supported what we expected was the highest levels of victimization, increased substance use. But for everybody else, it didn't really have an effect, which was great. But we also know that teenage substance use is something we have to continue to work at. And so this just tells us there might be different avenues we have to examine.
I want to talk about what causes kids to be targeted. I always think back when I was a little kid, I rode a bus that had kindergartners through eighth graders. And I remember when I was in first or second grade, seeing the boys in sixth or seventh grade, and relentlessly on the way home every afternoon, there was a boy named Michael who, to my eyes, didn't look any different from any of the other kids. He never was aggressive. He would just sort of sit there and hang his head, and they would not leave him alone. And I could not, to this day, I can't figure out what caused them to despise him so much and how miserable his life must have been.
There seem to be a few different avenues that that takes in sort of choosing a target. One is a target who's different. And so we know, for instance, that gay and lesbian students are much more targeted for bullying than their straight peers, or even individuals who just seem like they might be gay or lesbian. We know that kids who have disabilities are more likely to be targeted. In some communities, minority students are more likely to be targeted for bullying. And so part of it is just the other. And so that makes them an easy target because they stand out. We also know that students who don't fight back and when I say fight, I mean with words, who don't say stop. The more a student or a child can say, I don't like this, you need to stop, the better off they're going to be. But if like you said, poor Michael is sitting there hanging his head to the bully, that doesn't tell them that they have to change their behavior so they can keep going at it, because now they're clearly getting a reaction and they're clearly getting feedback from what they're doing that allows them to continue it. Mm. So, but unfortunately, we know that kids who are a little different can be at a higher risk than other children.
So when you talk about fighting back with words, that goes against the old advice, just ignore them and they will leave you alone. It doesn't sound like that works very well.
I don't think that works. I don't think any child who's been bullied would tell you that that worked. It's we find that what really helps is saying, stop. I don't like this. This is bothering me. And then turning around and walking away. But making sure that you use your words to tell somebody to stop what they're doing. And then we really recommend that students go tell an adult what just happened. Because as adults, we can come in and put in some other ways to make sure this behavior doesn't repeat itself. But it really helps to stand up for yourself in a verbal way. We don't advocate fighting back because that's going to get everybody in trouble. We don't want that to happen. But really standing up and saying, hey, knock that off. I don't like that. And I'm going to walk away now. That seems to be the direction that we're going.
So often kids are afraid that telling an adult will make things worse for them whenever that adult is not present.
Yes. So this is where I think we as adults have to get involved. And we have to recognize that when we intervene, there are consequences. And so we have to choose our interventions very carefully and very wisely. And so one of the things that some school districts have done is they've used anonymous reporting so that nobody knows who told on the mm-hmm. bully. And this allows everybody to kind of have this veil of anonymity and say, oh, it wasn't me, so they can't be targeted for it. And so that's been very helpful in some school districts. But also as adults, it doesn't help to go back and say to Tommy, hey, Johnny just came into my office and said this about you, because that's going to increase the probability that there's going to be an altercation after the fact. And so we have to be very conscious when we intervene that we are protecting the victim as well and not giving the bully an opportunity to re-victimize.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Donna in Dallas. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Great show today again. I wanted to ask you, why don't some of the friends of the kid that's getting bullied gather around the big bully and confront him and just say, hey, this is not acceptable. You're a bully. Stop it. I don't understand that.
That's a great question. And one that we've started to ask ourselves as researchers and as adults, and part of that seems to be because they don't want to then in turn be the victim, is it's one thing to know that what's happening to your friend is bad. It's another to be willing to take on that same experience. And so what a lot of schools are doing is they're looking into bystander intervention programs, which are showing to be a real promising practice moving forward, and it helps give other students the skills to stand up and do exactly that and say, hey, that's not appropriate behavior, and we don't want that behavior in our school. So we are working in that direction.
What do children need when they do tell an adult? Do they need the adult to, like, instantly get angry for them? Do they need just someone to listen? What are they looking for when they come talk to us?
I think one of the main things that children need is validation, that the way they're feeling, it's okay to feel that way, and that they are going to be helped. And what I really recommend that parents and teachers do is also talk to the victim and ask what the victim wants. Because sometimes the victim may just exactly that, want to talk to somebody, to have their feelings validated, to be reminded that they're important and they're special, and they can walk away. Other times they might need a change of a lunch table, or they might need a new friend to sit with, or maybe someone to keep an eye out in gym class, for instance. But we won't know unless we listen. And so helping the victim be part of the process to figure out what to do is really empowering and can help keep them from being re-victimized. But we have to validate. We have to we all too often as adults think, oh, that's just a petty kid problem, or wait till you're older and we'll show you a real problem. And that does not help at all. And we do have to listen and validate.
I don't know what this says about me. I think I would be more devastated to discover that my child was a bully than to discover that my child had been victimized. I would imagine some parents end up in denial when confronted with the idea that their child has been deliberately hurting other kids.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to be the parent of the bully for a lot of reasons. But among them is you now have to figure out how to address a behavior that I have no doubt you've taught your child is bad, you know. And so we don't want to blame parents of bullies, but it's really important that parents be open to the fact that their children could be making poor choices, because that's what adolescence is all about. It's their job to make poor choices, and it's our job to steer them in the right direction when we find out they've been doing that. So I really recommend that parents don't get defensive when they find out that their child has been engaging in some of these behaviors, but ask more questions. Oftentimes, at the end of the day, there's usually something that started this whole scenario of bullying. And if we listen long enough, we'll be able to figure it out and help the root cause of the problem for both the bully and the victim. So listen, talk to teachers and the principal, be open to what the school has to tell you. They're with your kids for a long time each day. They have an idea of what's going on. And then also be willing to take a step back and see if there are resources you need to take advantage of. And if so, take advantage of them, because it's a bump in the road, and it doesn't have to be any more than that if you address it.
We're speaking this hour with Nadine Connell, Assistant Professor of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about bullying. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative, we're talking to Assistant Professor of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas, Nadine Connell. We're talking about bullying, and if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. David is on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hello. Yes, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
And what I was just going to say is you were talking a minute ago about boys and trash talking and things. And the point I'd like to make, as somebody who came over here from another country and having an accent and being the different kid sort of thing, is that boys especially try to find that pecking order. And the example you gave of calling somebody names and things, well, that's, it's, if you don't stand up and defend yourself a little bit, such as somebody says, you're a jerk, call them back and say, well, you're a something hole. And if you don't do that, then you become the child who's got his head hung down and will be the one that everybody picks on. That's just the way of the world. If you're taught as a child to stand up and just give back what you get, you don't become the one that's bullied.
I really appreciate you calling in, and I do think it's one of the points that we do think is very important with children is to teach them to stand up for themselves and say, hey, I don't like that. I don't recommend calling them a name back because teachers don't like that, and that can escalate sometimes a problem, but we do want to give students the autonomy and the ability to advocate for themselves and say, hey, knock it off. That's not cool if that's how they feel.
So you want kids to be able to stand up for themselves. On the other hand, I would imagine that you are not eager to blame kids who get bullied because somehow they have failed to stand up for themselves enough.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's nobody's fault when they are bullied. No child deserves to be treated the way that bullies treat people. And what we want to do is come at it in two directions. Stop the bullies, but also give victims some ways to help themselves so that they can feel better about themselves and so that they can advocate for themselves. But it's also really important to remember it's the adult's job to create a safe space and a safe environment. It's teachers and parents and administrators. It's our responsibility to stop the bullying because no child deserves it. No child is responsible for it.
So if you have a child being bullied, first and foremost, you want that behavior to stop. My question is, what works? Do bullies respond best to being held accountable for their actions, maybe being punished, or do they do better with some face-to-face, I don't know, counseling or help to recognize the consequences of their actions?
So what works really depends on the individual factors of the bully. So one of the things when I work with schools and they come to me and they say, we want to reduce our bullying, what do we do about it? One of the things that we really advocate is creating a very positive school environment where tolerance is considered an important value and where we see any kind of bullying or just really negative behavior addressed immediately. So a lot of it is addressing it so that kids know that they can't push the boundaries. I mean, children will push boundaries. It's natural. And so it's our job to set that boundary and to be consistent when we set that boundary. So the first part is really setting our expectations and then expecting that students will meet those expectations and having consequences when they don't. And we can do that at a school level. There have also been newer approaches that are currently being researched now that look at what we call restorative justice in criminology. So the idea that we can sit bullies and victims down together and have a conversation about what's going on and what we can do to improve the situation. And that is showing positive early results. So we're really excited about the direction that that could take for schools. But there are going to be cases where individual counseling is necessary and where there may be other underlying issues such as aggression that have to be dealt with and are best dealt with in a professional setting. And that's where it's really important for parents to communicate with teachers, school counselors, and get that feedback, and also their family doctors to get resources for those times when they may be needed.
How often is it helpful to put either the bully or the victim in a different school, get a fresh start?
You know, that's an individual thing. I can think of stories and circumstances where it's been very helpful to students and stories where the initial problem didn't actually change. So the location changed, but the problem didn't change. So for instance, if you have an individual with mental health difficulties that are not being addressed, it's not going to matter what school they're in. They're still going to struggle without the proper help for that. And so a lot of that has to do with what the individual circumstances are and whether, like I said, there are other underlying problems that need to be addressed first.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
My question is, when I was in school, which was about 10 years ago, it was very popular to have zero tolerance policies on many things, truancy, tardiness, as well as bullying and fighting. And one thing that that led to was the widespread thought, it was very prevalent, that you had to be hit 3 times before you could hit back without getting in trouble. And it was common for someone who had never been in trouble before but was being bullied to go to a remedial school or an alternative school because they, quote-unquote, got in a fight that they very much probably didn't bring on themselves. And I was wondering if you had studied or thought about the effects that has on people that are being bullied when they see that.
That's a really great question and a great point. Zero tolerance policies have been very popular in recent years for a variety of things, including misbehavior in school. And many of us don't advocate zero tolerance policies to bullying only because so much bullying happens where teachers and administrators can't see it. And if they can't immediately address it, then it's no longer zero tolerance because it could have happened 5, 6, 7 times before it comes to their attention. And so students recognize that it's not being addressed immediately, and so it becomes kind of a joke. And as a result, you may have these situations where somebody was reached the end of their limit, decided to respond in a physically aggressive way, and then they get in trouble for it, whereas the initial aggressor doesn't always get in trouble. And that just has to do with the social complexity of trying to figure out the fight that happens in the cafeteria, for instance. And that's one of the reasons we've moved towards these restorative justice policies. And it's also one of the reasons that when parents ask me if their kids should fight back, I always say no. Go to an adult, unless they are in physical danger. If a student is in physical danger, obviously we want them to get out of physical danger as soon as possible. But hitting back doesn't seem to ever end well for anybody. That's where we really need to get adults involved.
We have a series of tweets here from Rick, who says, a male cliche, I know, but I changed elementary schools and an older, dumber kid would not stop teasing, pushing, taunting me for weeks. Today it would qualify as bullying. Then one day, little David, me, punched Goliath in the nose. It worked. I felt empowered. He never bothered me again. With stronger bullying policies, I might not have grown.
I'd like to hope with stronger bullying policies, you wouldn't have had to punch anybody in the nose, and the older kid would have gotten the help that he needed to not bother you or anybody else. And that's why we advocate standing up and saying, hey, stop it, knock that off. So hopefully it doesn't escalate that far.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Trish in Fort Worth. Hi, Trish.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I wanted to ask a question, and I think some of the responses that we just had kind of speaks to what I think might be a deeper issue, is that adult attitudes towards bullying are dismissive. And I'm wondering if there is any program or any sort of education to address that, because it seems if the things that happen to kids, to our kids, happen to us at work, we would be filing charges with the police and we wouldn't tolerate it. But because it's happening by children to children, it's just part of growing up or something you just have to deal with, or it's not that bad, et cetera. And it seems like the bullying, we can do all the bullying education for children that we want, but if we don't get parents on board to actually really believe it's a problem, then it's not going to change, because parents are probably bullying their kids.
You make a really great point about the fact that this is not something that obviously can be solved by children, and we need parents and adults and school administrators to get involved. And to some of the other callers' points is that 10, 15, 20 years ago, school looked very different. Technology looked very different. And some of these changes have created an environment that allows bullying to happen a little bit more often than it did, sometimes a lot more often than it did. And so as adults, we are not as aware of how these changes are impacting school, because we haven't been there in 20 or more years. And so that's something that we look at the school level, and really the responsibility of the schools to make sure that they are engaging with parents to the best of their ability. Certainly there are hurdles with that at times, but it's one of the reasons I'm excited to get to come here and talk about my research, is because it gets adults and parents to start thinking about it maybe from a different perspective about why this is an issue we have to continue to worry about.
Is there any research to indicate that authoritarian parents are more likely to raise bullies than permissive or authoritative parents?
So we don't have a lot of research about that for bully as the outcome, but there is some research that suggests that authoritarian parents may be more likely to raise more aggressive individuals. It's a very difficult area to study, because we are talking about asking people who have had problems as adults to look back on their life and tell us about their parenting, you know, that they received, which of course there can be bias there. But certainly we know that there are some parenting approaches that are more effective in helping to create tolerance and empathy and good problem solving skills than others. So there are some parenting approaches that seem to be preferred.
As a criminologist, what's different about the approach that you take to studying bullying than someone who is an expert in, say, child development?
I think one of the differences in our approaches as criminologists is that we are really concerned about how this affects long-term social outcomes. So, for instance, the study that we mentioned earlier that talked to, and I shouldn't say talked to, but asked a question of 14-year-olds, did you bully? And then we find out in their 40s and 50s that they are more likely to have violent criminal offending trajectories. And so this was such an important finding because those are the individuals that cost the most to society. And when we're talking about the connection, we do know that most juvenile delinquents grow up to be totally fine adults. You know, that's the great thing about growing up is we get better. But we do know that many adults who are in the criminal justice system had problems as juveniles. And so it's really important for us to be able to make connections that help with prevention to make sure that juveniles who are having issues, having problems, especially with aggressive behavior, can be helped and not then cost a lot of money to society or end up in the criminal justice system in the long run.
There are certain problematic behaviors that children have that need to be addressed but don't necessarily indicate there's something else wrong with them. I wonder where bullying falls in that.
So bullying is a tricky behavior because, as we've said, it can be something that kids do because their friends are doing it and so they get on the bandwagon, or it can be something that they're doing because they are very aggressive or they have other issues that need to be addressed. That's one of the reasons actually that we take bullying so seriously, is because on its face we don't know. We have to get more information about the situation, about the individuals involved, so that we can better divert individuals where they need to be diverted. And that's why we take it seriously, is because it can have really major consequences down the line.
You mentioned earlier that certainly bullies are going to hide this behavior from adult authority figures, but sometimes victims will too. What should parents be on the lookout for, teachers, you know, adults that care about these kids, if they're not going to say, hey, I'm being hassled at school every day?
No, that's a great question. And we really recommend that parents look for behavioral changes in their children. So if all of a sudden they have new friends, or they don't want to hang out with the same old friends, or they're not, or they're isolating themselves, those would be warning signs where you want to ask some more questions and dig a little bit deeper. Certainly friendships will change as students grow up, and sometimes if they change schools, but if you're seeing a real reluctance to hang out with certain kids, that's something that we would consider a warning sign. If you see a drop in grades, if you see, like I said, more isolation, obviously, as teenagers get older, they don't want to hang out with their parents, but they should still want to hang out with other people. So if they're hiding up in their room, we need to start asking some more questions.
Nadine Connell is Assistant Professor of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas and a co-author of two recent studies about the causes of bullying and the effects of victimization. She was here today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Nadine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Stephanie Kuo. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.